Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Welcome to the Seneca Podcast, a weekly discussion of current affairs in China. In this program, we'll look at books, ideas, new research, intellectual currents, and cultural trends that can help us better understand what's happening in China's politics, foreign relations, economics, and society. Join me each week for in-depth conversations that shed more light and bring less heat to the way we think and talk about China. Seneca is supported this year by the Center for East Asian Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, a national resource center for the study of East Asia. The Seneca podcast will remain free, but if you work for an organization that believes in what I'm doing with the podcast, please consider lending your support. You can get me at senecapod@gmail.com. You can also support me as an individual on the new Seneca Substack, substack.seneca.com. This week, I am delighted to have Carrie Brown on the program. Carrie, who is a professor of Chinese studies and director of the Lao China Institute at King's College London, is well known, I imagine, to most of the listeners here. He is an enviably prolific writer who embodies all the qualities I look for in an observer of contemporary China. His latest book, China Incorporated, The Politics of a World Where China is Number One, looks critically at the narratives about China that have become so pervasive in the English-speaking world and beyond. The book also offers a thoughtful and deeply informed perspective on the nature of Chinese power. It's one of the best attempts to right-size China's capabilities, its intentions, and its many limitations. What I especially love about the book is that it ranges over a lot of the issues and questions that I think are really at the very heart of the way that we think about China. And it does it in a way that's really accessible. It's not theory and jargon laden. And it really boldly applies the accrued wisdom that only comes of really immersing yourself in a topic for a very long time. I think it's an extended essay. It's not bogged down by, you know, methodology. And it really dares to ask and even try to answer those really big questions. So I'm really eager to speak with you, Carrie. Welcome to the show. You've been on before. It was years and years ago. So welcome back to Seneca. And really so glad that we could be together here in Salzburg.
Thank you very much. It's great to see you again, Kaiser. Really great to see you.
So I have to say that in reading your book, I experienced a strange combination of emotions. There's the thrill at seeing so many ideas that were, you know, so very much in agreement with my own on the one hand, but also the vexation of knowing that, well, I guess my ideas turn out to be not so original, and that somebody expressed them oh so much more elegantly. But one thing that really puzzled me, I'm going to start with this, is the title of the book, right? I can imagine somebody picking it up and thinking that it's going to be chiefly about, say, you know, China's brand of state capitalism or about its state-owned enterprises. You know, it's China Incorporated, after all. Instead, it's a book, you know, as I described just now, about the big, big ideas. Why the title? Why China Incorporated?
Well, I think the thinking was that it was trying to convey this idea that China is, for us at least, a kind of curious combination of political and economic kind of problems, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And this idea of an incorporation and incorporated, I think that was what the publisher was trying to convey. I think maybe right. The argument of the book is really more about shifting geopolitics. That's hard to capture. I mean, I know getting a kind of another book that doesn't start by talking about China dominating the world, well, I didn't want something like that. But I didn't want to say let's all start hugging China. You know, it's sort of in the middle. So I think that this was the compromise, but I think the subtitle, you know, kind of captures
it. Yeah, yeah. I might have just forwarded the subtitle and then not bothered with the rest. I mentioned in my intro to you just now that you have those qualities that I look for in anyone who's really engaged deeply in the study of China. For me, those are about humility, about sensitivity to bias, about historical acuity, about, you know, kind of a multidisciplinary, interdisciplinary approach, and most importantly, about cognitive empathy. You know, strategic empathy, I guess you could use that word in its place. That instinct and that capacity to try and understand and to articulate China's perspective. I think that that's at the root not only of wisdom, but also of morality when it comes to approaching not just China, but any country of consequence, right? Having that informed empathy. So when I talk to people about the importance of cognitive empathy, I find people embrace the idea. They really like the idea. But again, you know, it's one that requires people to know something about China, and often people just simply don't have the time or the attention span to steep themselves in it. So they rely on people like us to give them sort of a map of what are the important mental furnishings in the Chinese mind. What are those kind of habits of mind that you would kind of bring forward and you would tell somebody about? What would you identify as the things that we ought to keep firmly in mind when we're trying to see the world through Chinese eyes?
I mean, we're sitting in Salzburg in the middle of Austria. For Europeans who've been thinking about China for 500 years, there's always been this issue of what do Chinese believe? What is their worldview?
Right.
And in the Enlightenment, you know, there were three really important figures, Montesquieu, Voltaire, and Leibniz.
Right.
And in a sense, they represent the three sort of possibilities. Voltaire was probably an idealist about China, very idealistic. I think Leibniz was maybe the realist, trying to just understand it, basically through texts from China that had been translated by the Jesuits. And then Montesquieu was more about, this is a scary place, these sure. have scary values. And I think in an odd way, I don't know, Americans may be kind of also the same, but we are ambiguous in our feelings, as you say, our feelings towards China. It's not really that there's a lack of knowledge. There's a huge amount of knowledge about China. I mean, you know, the massive amounts that are produced by academics and all sorts of other people. What I find sort of interesting about the moment we're at now is that China, for the first time, really kind of reaches into our feelings.
Right.
And it's slightly thrown us, right? And you kind of have this incredible sort of problem of, well, there's this place, it's very prominent now because of its economy and all sorts of other things, and we don't really know what we feel about it. We kind of think, okay, it's good that there's so many people that have been lifted out of poverty, and, you know, that it's good that a developing country's gone, you know, doing well. But on the other hand, this is a place that we do not really feel comfortable with.
Right.
And I suppose my kind of interest now is why? Why do we have that feeling of discomfort? If this was India, you know, India's doing very, very well at the moment. Its economy is growing. It's a democracy. But you and I know India is not an unscary place, right?
Right.
It's extremely nationalistic. But because it's a democracy, I think we're all okay with that. With China, there seems to be this added element that not just that it's an authoritarian system, but there's something else about it not quite fitting in. And I don't think anyone's really kind of captured that. And I think when you talk about the kind of issues of feelings, that's the thing that makes us slightly uneasy and puts us out of our comfort zone. We think about China, it sort of makes us uneasy.
Sure.
And I'm interested in that.
And I do want to ask you about the source of that unease. You know, what is it that sticks in our craw about China's rise? But I want to, you know, come back to this, circle back to this. When you are standing in front of a classroom, as you so often do, and you're trying to, you know, teach students who haven't spent any time there, you know, and presumably, I mean, I think you do it very well in the book, you urge them to try to take on the Chinese worldview, just, you know, because it's an important thing to do. As I say, turn the chessboard around, even if it's just from a sort of know thy enemy kind of perspective. But still, you need to equip them with some of the features of that Chinese worldview. So what are some of your go-tos for that?
Well, I mean, China is in our world, right? I mean, there's Chinese students at universities, there's Chinese culture all around us, and it's not unfamiliar. The main thing is to say, this is not a mysterious place. It mm-hmm. is part of our environment now, in very prosaic ways, like part of the kind of, you know, manufacturing that we use. But also, it had a deep influence, certainly, on our culture. I mean, British people drink tea endlessly. That came from China. We, you know, used to use porcelain, and that's the technology from that came from China. Our gardens, you know, are designed, inspired by Chinese designs. So it's sure. not. This is not an unfamiliar place. I think it's really difficult now because the pandemic closed a lot down, and it's harder to get to China. Sure. And it's more difficult, has been more difficult for Chinese to get here. But I think the main thing that any educator can do is to say, this is not an unknown territory. You know, people can make sense of this because many of the aspects of China should be very familiar. I mean, they're not mysterious. And I think in the West, there's been a history of, as you know, in Orientalism and, you know, kind of those sorts of attitudes, deliberately making China more difficult than it is. It's not easy. But it's definitely not as difficult as a lot of people make out, I think.
Yeah, I struggle with the balance there, finding the right balance between, you know, you don't obviously want to orientalize, exoticize China. You do want to emphasize that common humanity. They're not all that. There is, we're not talking about a different alien species. But at the same time, these are people who have an entirely different socialization process. They, the pantheon of heroes and villains in their stories, their fables and fairy tales are very different from ours. Their historical reference are, you know, they're from a different world than ours. I mean, we can talk about, you know, things that in from Sumeria and Babylonia and those sort of make sense because there's some articulation at least between Western culture and the Fertile Crescent, but this is an entirely different frame of reference. I mean, the language is just shot through with references to stories from the Warring States. If any educated Chinese person isn't familiar with Cheng Yu, they're not a really educated person, right? The question that I really think is kind of at the heart of it, and I mean, it's been on your mind a lot. You gave a talk in Greece where it's a really main theme, and it threads through your recent book, and that's this question of whether and how, to use your language, the Enlightenment West can ultimately accommodate a powerful China that is predicated on values and norms that, as I suggested, are quite different from those on which the modern West is founded. I don't think we need to articulate exactly what these are. But just to avoid confusion, we're talking about, you know, electoral democracy, about rule of law, separation of powers, you know, all these things that get now lumped under universal values, freedom of expression, religious freedom, and so forth. I mean, this is something I've brought up with many guests over the years, but I'm curious for your take, especially because you aren't an American, and I talked to too many damn Americans. When did cultural relativism become so distasteful in mainstream Western political discourse? I mean, has it always been this way? I mean, your book sort of suggests that it has, that we've always had this absolutist streak that runs through our history. And yeah, for sure, I agree. But wasn't there a time not so long ago when, if you just, you know, suggested, as I did, that people with totally different national conditions, with a different geography, with different demography, and then all those things that I talked about, you know, in the socialization and the myths and whatnot, there was a time where people could have sort of accepted that might produce valid ethical values or political beliefs, right? Now I feel like you can't even raise the idea without somebody insisting that any instance of relativism is a slippery slope that'll take you to, you know, apologetics for Hitler.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think it's quite a, in a sense, there's a prosaic answer to that, which is the European, therefore the Western, I mean, because America came slightly afterwards, but the European engagement with China was predominantly from the sort of middle of the 18th century onwards about having military and economic resources that meant that we could get our way in China.
Right.
And it's a story of coercion. And I mean, I think that sort of obviously built up a mindset that as we are getting our way and we have the power to do that, we therefore must be thinking in the right way. I mean, the problem with the relationship with China is, for Europeans at least, it's not a straightforward colonial story. I mean, it's a semi or an informal colonial story. Mm. the British relationship with China, which was so important. So I've just done a history of Britain's relations with China from the beginning till today, is this sort of incredible story of Britain being mostly opportunistic and coercive and having enormous advantages in terms of its technology, in terms of its access to global markets, mm-hmm. in terms of its capital and its ideas. It was dominant. And I think 100 years of that, I mean, there was 100 years of that from the first Anglo-Chinese War really down to the Second World War, kind of instilled this idea that, okay, in all respects, we as British, we as Europeans, maybe to a less extent, we as Americans, are definitely doing things better than China, right? I mean, and therefore this place is marginal, this place is inferior to us, and it has a decrepit culture. The interesting thing about this idea of China being a stagnant, sort of decaying culture came about after the McCartney mission in 1793-4. Sure. When a guy called John Burrough, who was part of that mission, wrote this very influential book, one of the first books on China in English, which gave that story. And that story got lodged there. So I think for the case of China, it's not so much about cultural relativism. It's about cultural disdain. It's about a strong sense of cultural disdain. This is a rickety, falling apart, dysfunctional place. And I think that narrative is very deep. And now we have a big disruption. This place is not so rickety. These people have built 40,000 kilometers of high-speed train. America hasn't built a single kilometer. Britain has built 100 kilometers and will take another 100 years to build another 100 yeah. kilometers. This place is kind of... What is sort of interesting is not that China would be number one. I don't know if China would be number one. But what I do know is that the idea that China could be number one has completely freaked a lot of people out. And I'm really fascinated by that, because what's the problem? Fifth of humanity is doing okay. I think some years ago you put on a social media post, you know, this idea of China being existential evil. Where did that come from? You know, the Communist Party of China being existential evil. You know, where this sort of idea that we are dealing with somewhere that is, because it's doing okay in some respects, a place which therefore is going to be a problem for us as Westerners, I find sort of fascinating, because it's not so much what this place is and what it's doing. It's more and more about us.
Yeah.
And that whole kind of political debate, you probably observe it a lot in America. It's about us, and us kind of being unsettled, unhappy, uneasy, and not knowing why. I mean, this is the sort of extraordinary situation that we're in. We are our biggest problem in this issue.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. I find this to be very much the case. I wrote an essay a few years ago. I don't remember if you saw it, and if not, I can send it to you. But I wrote it in the summer of 2020, when after the killing of George Floyd, we saw, you know, the streets of America erupt, and we saw white America grab the guns and go out in the streets. There's this iconic photo of this. I think he's a lawyer and his wife wearing, you know, sort of preppy clothing and armed, pointing their guns at these scary black protesters who, you know, who are calling for you know, reform of the police. And it occurred to me that what we're seeing in microcosm in the United States, the day of the white man coming to an end, seeing, you know, the coming of a majority minority country, that they're acting out there in these sort of spasmodic paroxysms of inchoate violence, right? And I feel like if you zoom out and look at the macro, the world, I mean, America, the West maybe, is that same man, that man and his wife in that pink Izod shirt with the gun. And this time it's, you know, this red colossus, you know, it's China that is the big threat. But, you know, there's all sorts of things that you talk about in the book that you kind of add up to what sticks in the Western craw about China. I mean, there's a lot of people point at values, right? I mean, I think that there's an argument to be had over whether the values come first or whether the values are really just sort of rationalization for other kind of atavistic resistance to the idea that our primacy could be challenged. What are some of the other ideas that you introduce in the book that address this?
I mean, I think at the heart of it is an intellectual commitment in the West to what the French philosopher François Julien called the universal. Mm-hmm. I mean, from ancient Greece and the time of Plato, the idea of the universal being something that is intellectually dominant, you know, that we must have a kind of generic sort of idea that applies to everyone, everywhere, all the time. And I think, of course, China, in an interesting way, quite consciously contests this. Wang Hui, the kind of Beijing academic who wrote this colossal, you know, intellectual history of modern China.
Yeah, I'll be talking to Rana about that book, actually. He reviewed it.
So the thing is, from beginning to end, this book comes back to this issue again and again and again of the validity of the idea of a Chinese version of its own universalism. I mean, a sort of contesting view of the world,
right,
which is valid. And I think Wang Hui talks in, you know, the work of Kang Youwei, the intellectual at the end of the Qing dynasty, of this idea of universal Confucianism,
right,
which I think captures it well. And I think this is really one of the issues about value discourse today, when Xi Jinping, you know, in document number 9 or whatever, talks about, we don't subscribe to the universalist values of the West, but it's fine, you can have them, right?
Right.
You can have your universalism, but we don't buy into it. And I suppose that is quite a kind of interesting issue for all of our kind of intellectual environment in the West, where we really think that there are all sorts of kind of, you know, values and propositions and mindsets which must apply to everyone. And I think China is the great dissenter. This is a weird thing. A country that doesn't like dissenters and dissidents, China is the great dissident.
You have a fantastic section of the book that I actually quoted. I put it on Twitter because I thought it was just so well. I've highlighted it here. Just give me a second to find it. I mean, you talk about exactly this kind of Western universalism and two competing versions of exceptionalism. Some people might take issue with the idea that China's particularism could be called exceptionalism.
Yeah.
You write, the main question posed in recent times is how a world pushes back against a China rolling towards it, promoting its own values and seeking to undermine and replace those of the Enlightenment West. The better question is how China can be a global player when its worldview is constructed in ways which are both immediately alienating because of their syncretism and complexity. We'll get to syncretism in a bit. And because of the way they insist on being uniquely and distinctly Chinese. A world where China plays an increasingly larger role is not likely to be one where its belief system and worldview swamp the minds of everyone else, and where everyone then magically become practitioners of Sinified Marxism-Leninism with important traces of Confucianism, Taoism, and Buddhism. I could add a bunch of other things to that list, you know, is much more likely to be a world of long-term structural divisions where the issue is not so much that China is a power rising to global prominence with a competing coherent belief system the rest can adopt, but for precisely the opposite reason, that it in fact does not have an alternative and its rise will make the world more complex, not simpler. I thought that was really, really quite profound. It's something that I borrowed this from somebody a long time ago. You know, somebody once said, American exceptionalism and Chinese exceptionalism are equally arrogant. They're equally intolerable in that way. One says, basically, that, you know, American institutions and values are valid for all time and all places for all people. Mm. And, you know, the Chinese version says, these are, you know, we put this Chinese characteristics on there for a reason, right? You know, these are for us. It's a Chinese thing. Y'all wouldn't understand, right? I thought that's one of the really interesting issues that you really plumb the depths of in this book, and it's really great for that reason. Let me get back to this sort of why China's rise kind of sticks in the craw. I mean, part of what seems to really bother Americans is that China seems again and again to undermine what I've called in the past like load-bearing walls of American exceptionalism. Let's take, for example, this idea that you're not supposed to operate a market system without a democratic form of government in place, right? And yet China does it. Chaz Freeman once joked that it's like the bumblebee. It's not supposed to be able to fly, and yet it flies. And that really bothers us somehow. And then, you know, more recently, it's like you weren't supposed to be able to innovate in the absence of free flow of information. And then technology was supposed to bring down authoritarian regimes. Now it's somehow been enlisted in the preservation of them. So these things, again, these are sort of pillars. They were axiomatic beliefs for Americans, especially, and they've been undermined. But you have a fantastic analogy. You use kind of a sports analogy. Sport, as you Brits call it. It's kind of strange how you say maths, but we say math. We say sports, but you say sport. But in any case, China is playing this game that we wrote the rules for, the West wrote the rules for, but they're not doing it in the kind of sportsmanlike way that we expect. They're supposed to do it, you know, because it's what gentlemen do, and it's exercise. But they're actually playing to win. You know, they're not.
Yes, I mean, so you probably would have difficulty understanding this. It's like soccer for an English person. So an English person, soccer is for English people a constant desire to find excuses for why we never win the game we thought we invented, right? So since 1966, when we last won the World Cup, every 4 years during the World Cup, we go through this bizarre kind of festival of making excuses and, you know, saying, well, it's because the referee cheats, or it's because the pitch wasn't flat. And when I hear complaints about China's success in some areas, it seems to me that this is what I'm hearing. I'm hearing some people in an English pub moaning about why we got booted out of the World Cup, you know, and didn't win. China's sort of success isn't something, to be honest, I knew. When I first went to China in 1991, I think I probably did have this idea. This is why I'm sort of maybe kind of writing this material now, because I did used to think passionately that China had to become like us. I thought in the 1990s, you know, when I was living in Inner Mongolia in China, this place has got to kind of basically adopt, you know, the political structures of the West, because I think that's what many people thought,
right,
in order to take it to the next level. When it joined WTO in 2001, when I was a diplomat in Beijing, I mean, we all thought, it'll get so far, but it's got to have legal reform, it's got to have political reform, transparency, accountability. I wrote a book about village democracy after going around China in 2009, absolutely certain. I met the head of the Ford Foundation, I met people who were funding democratization in China. The European Union was funding village democracy in Sichuan, I think it was, or Yunnan, passionately believing this was the future: accountability, participation, competition for power. And I suppose since then, things have changed, not just in China, but with us. I mean, we've seen democracy go through some terrible shock tests. And it's not to say that it's not going to prevail, but in America, in Europe, in Britain, many places, democracy has really been through a turbulent time.
Sure.
And the one thing that has really stuck is what's happened in Russia. I mean, I think in the 1990s and early 2000s, it was, okay, this place is on a tricky path to full democratization. We now, in 2024, are sitting in a Europe where Russia has attacked Ukraine and where the principal opposition politician, Navalny, has just been butchered, you know, right, or died in most mysterious circumstances.
In prison.
In prison. And so I think it's not just that China's become the way it's become and, you know, kind of complicated, but still successful in some ways. I think that it's also because our feelings about our own systems are more complicated. It's just a case of, it's not easy to say to China now, you must adopt this set of processes and protocols in order to take it to the next level from us, because it's not easy to look at us as a great model of success in building harmony in society. That's going to, you know, maybe that will change. Maybe in 5 years' time, it will all be good. But as of today, very, very hesitant to say that China should look very hard at what the West, or the European West, an American West does, Because I think that we are in a very difficult moment.
Yes, but of course, you know, what we always do is we say, no, 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 don't look at what the reality is. Look at our ideal, right? I mean, it's always a comparison of the Chinese reality to this American ideal. That's one of the things that really frustrates me. Related to this, and this is the thing that I actually want to push you on a little bit, because I don't fully agree. You talk about how in four consecutive American presidencies, from Clinton through Trump, there was this belief that engagement was going to transform China, just as you said, to make it more like us. And yeah, you find statements from each of these administrations that seem to suggest that, yeah, there was that assertion. In the case of Trump, it was that Mike Pence speech at the Heritage Foundation or the Hudson Institute or whatever, one of these conservative think tanks. But, you know, that was a pronouncement of, oh, well, that whole endeavor was a failure. And you seem to agree that was a failure. So I want to push on two fronts here. One is that I actually think that's a bit of a straw man. I don't think that engagement was thought of seriously. I think it was when they did make those utterances, it was sort of to sell it to a certain constituency. That's not the core reason that they believe. They did not believe that engagement was going to magically transform China into a liberal democracy. So I actually am constantly arguing with people who make that assertion. The other, though, is that let's say we did think that was the case. Let's say we did. Could you reasonably, as somebody who had gone to China in the early 90s, and looking at it from 92, say, to 2012, wouldn't you say that it had become, quote-unquote, more like us, at least more tolerant, more diverse, it was more free market, that, you know, personal liberties had expanded tremendously. It certainly hadn't moved in the other direction. I'm talking, again, before 2012. And I think it's fair to say that it was in precisely those geographies where contact was highest, where exposure was greatest, that people's minds and their lives changed the most. That seems to suggest that even in that formulation of engagement, it did work, or it was working.
These are two fantastic points. I think on the first of our engagement, and did we expect, or did America really expect that to happen? I suppose as someone who was an official, like briefly from 98 to 2005, we certainly were in the business of saying, we can tell you good things about how you can change for the better.
Sure.
And I give examples in the book. I mean, the European Union, it produced a document in 2006.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you specifically about this. These two, this is the UK one and the European Union. So please tell us about both of these. I hadn't.
No, they're so the ones, both of them are classic sort of, well, look, we really want you to succeed on our terms. You need to democratize, you need to improve your legal system. And I mean, they're sort of really kind of helpful in a weird way, because I mean, that's all disappeared now. If you look at the 2016 EU document, which I had some input into when I was running a kind of project for the European Union, it's all about, we need stuff for ourselves now. I mean, we need reciprocity. I suppose it's a bit like Trump. You know, these people have done too well. We need something back, you know, and they haven't done what we expect them to. So I suppose it wasn't so much, you're probably right, it wasn't really a sort of idea of, oh, they're going to become a nice political democracy like us. It was really, they're going to do stuff that's going to be super helpful for us, right? They're going to have rule of law and stuff that's going to be helpful to our businesses. It's all going to be predictable. And that didn't happen, right? Xi Jinping did not do that. I mean, I think on the kind of issue, you're right, you're really right. Up till 2012, China did seem to become more pluralistic. I think that's right. And it is surprising for all of us how since then things have changed. And there's all sorts of complicated reasons for that. One area which I think is really weird is, it seems to me one of the principal problems of what China's doing, it's not that it's a socialist country still, or that it's got this political system. It's that it practices a form of capitalism which is raw and extremely pure.
Right.
If you look at Darren Byler's excellent book on Xinjiang, very sensitive issue.
Yeah.
The great thing about that book is it doesn't talk about the G word, where we get awful sort of problems. And I do deal with that a little bit in my book. It talks about Xinjiang is a profit center for rampant terror capitalism.
Right.
People are making big money here, and it's extremely raw the way it deals with people. Margaret Hildebrand at Oxford has just written a good book about the precariat in China, the people who didn't win out, and pretty brutal stories.
Yeah, yeah.
3 million people have lost limbs in factories in China in the last 20 years. I mean, this is the most raw Dickensian form of capitalism. And I think one of the issues is not that China is dissimilar to us in this respect. Capitalism is really, really pure. It's the kind of capitalism I suspect a lot of big multinationals would love to practice. No real labor rights, no social welfare, no soft infrastructure. People sink or swim.
Yeah.
That's the really weird thing. It's not China's dissimilarity to us in this area.
It's hyper-similar.
It's really, really similar. Yeah. And that's also kind of what I really didn't expect. I think we started to see it in the 2000s. Yeah, in the late 1990s with the state, you know, enterprise layoffs under Zhu Rongji, I think we started to see the state disappearing, right? I remember being there, you know, the Danway system basically disappearing. Right. People being able to do things, you're right, you know, marry and do things, study things at university, which before they didn't have the choice. And then in the 2000s, you really saw chaos. I remember going to Huahuatl in Inner Mongolia in 2006. They'd had 36% growth the previous year.
My God.
The place was just an absolute carnival. I mean, everyone was making money. Officials, you couldn't tell them apart from business people. I mean, they were just sort of foisting projects. I mean, everyone was going there. We all put our spoons into this great big rich brew, right?
Right.
And everyone was basically going nuts. And I think that definitely created, I guess, a cultural and a social disorientation. And the puritanism of the Xi Jinping era, I think, is in a sense a response to that.
Absolutely.
You know, kind of, we've got to, business people and cadres have got to be, you know, separate. We've got to have some sort of ethical system. I think it's kind of a pushback against that. It was, I guess, to be expected. But you're absolutely right. Sitting in Beijing in 2008, no one saw it coming.
Right. And so, I mean, that takes me to my next question, which is something of an obsession of mine. I mean, it's something that I have thought an awful lot about, which is why things changed. And I mean, I've explored, there's so many excellent books that have been written on this or you know, that have pieces of it. Probably my favorite is Susan Shirk's book, which is called Overreach. And, you know, what she really wanted to name Overreach and Overreaction, which I think would be a more maybe balanced and fair way to talk about it. Because, yeah, it does talk about Chinese overreach, but that's not all of it. As you probably know, her theory about how just that sort of chaos that you described, which produced a lot of wealth, but a lot of corruption and a lot of, you know, power centers. That's the theory I like. I you know, talked about this a couple of weeks ago with Jeremy Goldcorn, you know, when we were sort of taking a ramble down memory lane and talking about how that's been a leitmotif for the last 14 years of this show, talking about why things shifted after the great financial crisis.
You lived in China in the 2000s.
I did.
So
I
you were
the whole time. And yeah.
Were you
96
conscious?
To 2016. So
were you did you feel in the 2000s that it was just chaos? And
absolutely. It was fun and wonderful and totally chaotic. And I have this whole mea culpa about how I drank that, you know, neoliberal Kool-Aid as well. I mean, I had sort of become so reflexively supportive of anything that was like on the side of, you know, private enterprise, on the side of market liberalization. And so I'm curious what your explanation is of the hardening of that turn that took place after. What are the favorite variables that you like to single out as to why it changed? Because it started before Xi Jinping. I mean, we all see it, you know, accelerate under Xi, but before that already, what was happening?
So, I mean, I think one of the great paradoxes is that when the Enlightenment West wants to influence China, like the European Union and Britain did with their documents about changing China, you know, that we referred to earlier, it never really works. When we do it consciously, when we act unconsciously, we impact on China.
I couldn't agree with you more.
So the 2008 Great Economic Crisis, I think, really had a big impact. I remember, you know, being in China a lot of the time, and I remember the bewilderment by people of, wow, we knew that you could screw up politically because of what you did with Russia in the 1990s, you know, but we thought you were good capitalists. But you're also terrible capitalists, right? You've screwed up. And the head of the European kind of finance mechanism, you know, it's kind of basic sort of European bank, went to Beijing to try and get bailout money for, you know, the Greeks that were bailing out then. Greek official told me at the time that Greek per capita GDP was something like 6 times higher than China. And they wanted to work out, why are we going to get money from a place that is still really, really developing? This is really, really screwed up. I think that had a big impact. And I think, you know, many things in the West since then have made, I suppose, Chinese theorists, particularly Wang Huning, the great ideologue, and, you know, under Xi Jinping, they look at this kind of chaotic world and they think, we probably don't need to take too many lectures from you. We really need to be wary of what you're telling us. I think that that's one thing that I would kind of attribute it to. And then more recently, I think, oddly enough, the impact of the Trump presidency was also an unconscious, big, big impact on China. I mean, you know, yeah, this sort of, wow, okay, wow, this system can produce some really unexpected results. You know, and you remember the famous story about how the Chinese diplomats were Hillary Clinton sort of big bang, you know, event in 2016 in the election, and then they had to race to the different event like a lot of other people. I think that also had a big impact.
Yeah, yeah.
And this is not, so it's not about that there may or may not be reasons to have voted for Trump. I mean, I'm not dealing with American politics. It's about expectations outside. And I think China realized that this is not a predictable partner the way we thought. This is not a predictable place the way we thought. And that has really kind of made it more double down on itself, if that makes sense. So it's more about exogenous things rather than necessarily domestic things. But I think that those two events, particularly the Trump presidency and the 2008 financial crisis, and the 2008 financial crisis more profoundly, we would not have Xi Jinping in the way we have him now without 2008. I'm absolutely convinced of that.
Yeah. We tend so badly to overestimate our own ability to impact things in China. And also, we radically underestimate it. At the same time, it's
when we screw up, we really impact on China. And we're doing it very well lately.
One of the things I really love about this book, and I think it was one that I think was refreshing and very original, was that you turn that standard question of what does China want completely on its head, and you ask, what does the West want from China? And you actually put that before the what does China want section of the book. What does a meditation on what the West wants from China produce? What are the big takeaway insights that you came from putting that question in there first?
Yeah, I mean, so looking at the British case, and the time when Britain had the most power over China at the end of the 19th century, we were running the Chinese fiscal system, the imperial customs, maritime customs, which was a third of Chinese government revenue.
Sure.
A British guy, Robert Hart, ran that. And in between having various love childs in Shanghai, he ran the imperial customs service. And, you know, kind of at that time, British policy was driven. We did have a policy. We had a huge influence in China, most investment, you know, massive, massive amount of influence. Our policy was, we don't want a China that's too strong. We definitely don't want a China that's too strong. We don't want a China that's falling apart. We don't want to get involved with China and have a second India. We want something in between. It's like the Goldilocks thing. Not too hot, not too cold, just right. This is why the kind of question of what do we want? We want quite contradictory things. We want a China that isn't going to fall apart, okay? And Xi Jinping's cool for that, right? Because he kind of holds this, you know, scary Xi, he holds it all together. We definitely don't want a China that's going to fall apart. But we want a China that kind of fits in. And I think that that's clearly, that was always impossible. And a China that is wealthier and more able to, you know, kind of define what it wants, it is not going to fit into that. That's the problem. Our policies, on the whole, we're still kind of living with this fond dream until about 15 years ago. And if you notice, since we kind of realized, oh, those sort of binaries of, you know, falling apart and just sort of basically being, you know, completely powerful and dominating us, these are sort of, you know, kind of not really immediately going to happen, our policy has become really incoherent. I mean, I'll give you an example. Britain and then the European Union, and then America produced this sort of, what is it, competitor, collaborator, and then adversary.
Yeah, the three C's, right?
Yeah, I mean, what kind of, what world do we live in where, you know, you basically say to someone, I like you today, I don't like you tomorrow, and I'll tolerate you on Wednesday, right? I mean, it sort of doesn't make, it's very complicated. China has this very simple narrative of, we're all friends, we all work together, win-win. I mean, of course it's rhetoric, but it sort of is more coherent. We have become, I think, overcomplicated and very incoherent because at the heart, our policy position itself is quite unstable.
Absolutely. We want a China that is a responsible stakeholder in the corporation that we built. Yeah. We want a China that's a rule taker, not a rule maker still, right? Obama, I think, was probably quite sincere when he said that a strong and stable China is good for the world, yeah? I think a lot of Chinese liked the phrasing of that. But I think the flip side of that coin was, right, that it wasn't going to disrupt the order that America built.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And I think the issue of a China that fits in, well, we kind of lived up till 2012, you know, in the Hu Jintao period, with a China that irritated us because it didn't say what it wanted. And now we have a China that does sort of say what it wants, the Belt and Road Initiative and stuff like this. And that's a problem too. So right. It kind of should make us reflect. I mean, this is not all about how we get things wrong. If you look at the three peace proposals that China has made for Russia, Ukraine, the Israeli-Gaza military kind of confrontation, and then more recently on the South China Sea, I don't know. I mean, these are not fit for purpose, right? China is also in a bind because as the West becomes more conflicted and more panicky, we're running out of answers, really. I mean, necessarily, we don't have the capacity. You know, the Russia-Ukraine war is not going to... It's had a huge economic impact. It's pushed energy prices through the roof. China is going to have to probably do more than it wants on this at some point. It's not going to be easy for it. It doesn't really... That's what I worry about. Not a China that's proactive, but a China that is sort of, when it's bought in and really has a role to play, just sitting on its hands and saying, no, it's nothing to do with us. We've got to keep out of this.
This is what's called the Kindleberger trap. I don't know if you're familiar with it. Yeah, where, you know, the incumbent power is either unable or unwilling to provide public goods in the world. Mm-hmm. But the rising power, it doesn't want the rising power to step in and do the same. And the rising power in this case isn't particularly good at it. I mean, it's very good at building that infrastructure and stuff like that, but it doesn't have that, you know, the trading currency, and it doesn't have, you know, that, right. Frankly, the moral authority or the interest in doing it. One of the things that I thought was really interesting was how you use the internet as a way of looking both at China's opportunistic exercise of power, but also at the limitations of its power. Because, you know, this book really, after all, is a meditation on power. And I think it's most compelling when it's making, you know, really good points about that. I think, for example, we've just been talking about how we're so used to thinking of China as the complicated one. And you kind of turn this around and say, actually, it's our policy that is complicated. We are hard to understand. I mean, I often ask myself, you know, put yourself in the Chinese person's shoes and look at our... I mean, how can you make sense of American policy or of Western policy toward China? It's impossible to make sense of it. I mean, can you imagine how frustrating it would be to try to write that report for Xi Jinping or for, you know, Wang Yi?
Well, I did think of the morning when Trump was elected, the poor guy at the Ministry of Foreign Affairs sort of having to explain, well, you know, we gave all this analysis saying it was definitely going to be Hillary. Well, sorry. The only excuse is that everyone else kind of didn't see that coming too. Yeah, I mean, I think the complexity is a kind of really big thing. But to come back to the thing we were saying just before about
internet.
What do we, you know, well, not so much, but what do we want? I mean, what do we want? I mean, I've had to sit probably like you through business and, you know, kind of many other sorts of meetings of people going to China. And you probably did this when you were there. You know, if people came, you said, yeah, I'll kind of help you out. And, you know, you go along.
Sure.
And then you kind of realize they don't know what they want. I mean, they've come and they have this sort of vision of a big market, right, for instance. Or they have this vision of, you know, big technology that they might, or something. They have something quite abstract, but they don't really know what they want. And how can that ever work? You know, it's got to be quite... So for all of the complexities we've been talking about, to go into this territory with a lack of a strategic kind of objective seems to me very, very weird. China's strategic objective is quite simple. Strong, powerful country, sustainable one-party rule. I mean, this kind of nailed it in 5 or 6 seconds. So they have that as an advantage. Our strategic objective is a bit fuzzier. The internet, I think Liu Xiaobo, the dissident Nobel Prize winner...
Also died in jail.
That's right, yeah. He wrote that God made the internet for China because of this wonderful network. But what you and I probably remember is in the 1990s, there was this when it appeared like, yeah, you know, this is going to really be a way of new ideas coming into China. And it has been.
It
but
was,
it's also,
absolutely, yeah.
It's kind of hit this environment where these ideas have then been transformed. It's also created, the Chinese state has created with, you know, people like, is it Fang Xingbing, you know, the architect of the Great Firewall, a Chinese internet.
Sure.
Very good representation of what we were talking about earlier, of universalism and localism in Chinese.
Sure.
It's created this global generic technology with its Chinese characteristics. And I think that's a sort of amazing metaphor for so many other things that have happened. The internet in China was firstly about big expectations, the fact that, you know, we could really have leverage. Then it was about the creation of something very bespoke. Then it was about kind of the, you know, sort of ways in which it gave you a great insight into Chinese hybridity. Now, I mean, it's really an audit of chaos everywhere. I mean, even in China, the internet is very chaotic. And
arguably less so than...
Yeah, yeah, I mean, but some... you know, students of mine at King's College London, you know, they kind of show the sorts of, you know, for instance, events that were happening in Britain. They show little bits about what Chinese views were. They show about Chinese nationalism and the way that that's expressed.
Sure.
And I think these are...
The piano guy.
Yeah, yeah. So these are sort of informative, but they're as informative as if you look at Twitter most days or whatever it's called now, X... And you kind of get news about American politics. It's extremely chaotic. So all you can say is that the Chinese internet and the outside world internet are not easy to interpret. That's all.
We talked just now about hybridity, and one of the themes that you come back to again and again is China's syncretic tendency, the ability of it. I like this idea, and I think that it there's a resonance to it, but I'm always a little cautious when I want to make sort of sweeping pronouncements about how the ability to fuse or to harmonize Buddhism, Confucianism, and Taoism, how that's really is that a habit of mine that has endured into the modern world? Maybe I don't know. I guess. I see some evidence for it. Well, you're pretty comfortable with that idea. And what does that mean in today's world? What does that allow China to do, and what does that prevent China from being able to do?
I mean, I can give you a story about my encounter with Chinese syncretism in the flesh. In about 2009, I was invited to the Heilongjiang Academy of Social Sciences to do a lecture in Harbin about the Chinese environment. Marx and the Chinese environment. Now, if you Google Marx and the environment, you will get about three references because he didn't write much about the environment. So I was really sort of stuck with this, and I found some material in the end. I gave my lecture. The very kind people at the Academy of Social Sciences, Marxism-Leninism Department in Harbin, took me to a very nice bar afterwards, you know, and they obviously were really relaxing. Oh, great. Nothing terrible happened. This Lao Wai didn't come along and shoot his mouth off. You know, we it all went well. And I remember the party secretary, he got this Harbin beer. Yeah, really nice Harbin beer.
Hoppy, I love that stuff.
It was just, he was just lifting it to his parched lips. You could tell it's been a tough day looking after this foreigner, and he was just about to kind of quaff it. And then, I don't know, this question struck in my head, and I said, do you really believe in Marxism? And he kind of just, he looked at me like, oh, God's sake. And then he came out with this, which is like kind of like, well, how do you say, look, just leave it. And I sort of thought then we're obsessed by what do these people believe? But actually, do they have to believe? I mean, people in Britain, what do we believe? I mean, we you know, you have people who are professing, you know, profess a particular kind of religion. They practice, maybe. But if you ask them to unpack their beliefs, it's about, you know, maybe traditions or anything, but they wouldn't articulate it. They just do it. And I think in China, it's not different, really. Marxism, Leninism is not really something people might, you know, even this guy whose profession it was, might have a big, big knowledge of. They just kind of feel that, okay, this answers some very boring questions that we don't really know what we think about. I think that might be the way in which we can understand the flexibility of Chinese thinking. There are deeper questions about, you know, in the past, Buddhism, Taoism, you know, Confucianism, how do they fit in this world? And the European encounter with that in the Enlightenment period three or four hundred years ago was always a bit of a tussle. You know, okay, what do we make of these people who don't have a very unified belief system like in the Judeo-Christian West? I mean, I think that's significant. But today what you see is an incredible pragmatic flexibility. So underneath the sort of rigidity of the Xi Jinping practice of politics and the organization, administration of politics.
The Leninist piece of it, yeah.
The Leninist piece of it. And also the technological capacity that now exists to do that. Underneath that, I think that Chinese people that I know are admirable in the way in which they are admiring of the West still in many ways. Mm-hmm. They are accepting of many things about Western culture, but they have a profound sense of their own identity. And I think that's where it's not so much about this sort of syncretism. It's about how that impacts on people's identity. Because in my interpretation, the big difference now is that Chinese people, I think, might have a stronger sense of we know who we are. And I think in Europe, in America, we don't maybe feel so comfortable with that question. Who are we?
We're certainly struggling right now.
We're struggling. And I think Wang Huning, you know, the great architect of this was politically a kind of very powerful move. It's not about the economy. It's not about politics. It's about culture and identity. That's where the stuff happens. And in fact, the architect of the European Union, I think it was Schuman, in the 50s, he said, you know, he was asked years later in the 70s, you know, what did you get wrong? And he said, we should have done the culture first, not the economics, not the politics, the culture. I think under Wang Huning, you know, and Xi Jinping is the child of Wang Huning, really, it's about the culture. The culture is the really important thing.
Which is, you know, scary in its own way. I mean, it's because of this effort to sort of scale out the culture that we see what's happening in Tibet and what's happening in Xinjiang. You know, it is easy to go from there to full-blown ethno-nationalism.
Yeah, yeah, that is the danger. That's absolutely right.
Very, very big danger. One of the other canards that I think you go after really well, and I love, you know, we are always hearing how the Chinese lay these grand plans, right? You know, 100-year marathons and what have you. You know the books I'm talking about. I mean, there's one that was sort of the Bible of the Trump White House, and there's another one that unfortunately has taken, you know, grabbed a lot of sort of currency in the NSC. But you, I think, subscribe to the idea, which I think is the right idea, that they muddle through just like everyone else. They don't. We attribute to them this preternatural ability to lay these grand schemes out and follow through on them. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think in the 80s, there was this famous line from Deng Xiaoping, you know, about reform and opening up, and how town and village enterprises, they were created at the time, you know, in basically rural areas to employ people, and were very successful. They like small companies, and they did huge amounts of productivity. And he said, we never planned that. We never planned that. I mean, and they were big, big players in the reform.
Sure.
And I think actually we don't sort of maybe appreciate, or certainly not people who don't look at it in more detail, how opportunistic the political system in China is. I mean, politics is always about opportunity. And I think in the past, it's certainly been quite opportunistic. And so, yeah, you can have these big, big grand plans. I mean, we all have them. My college has a 2029 vision, because we were founded in 1829. So our 2029 vision is to make the world a better place. Okay, this is very laudable. This is our plan, right? And every day, you know, we want to make the world a better place. I mean, I think a lot of universities in
Britain.
The
World Economic Forum's motto.
Yeah, I mean, that's another fact. You know, Davos Forum, you know, these sorts of highly generic kind of visions. But in terms of local provinces, you know, China is a very complicated political structure, extremely complicated. And I think, you know, if you look at the implementation of policy, it's not, you know, the great kind of policies, the reform and opening up, they gave latitude to provinces and others to create space. Again, to go back to football, you know, great kind of footballer creates space, right? You create space and then you boot the ball and, you know, you don't have a real big plan, but you broadly know where to boot it. And I think with the policies in the past, they gave space. It's a big question today whether that's still the case. I mean, a lot of kind of the anti-corruption campaign and others have created maybe a fearfulness. You would say that probably China needs to go back to that ethos of having a lot of latitude for local and, you know, kind of provincial officials because of the economy at the moment. But in recent years, I think they've been squeezed.
Let's talk about chapter 6 in your book, which I think is, I mean, it's called, you know, it's on the dark side of Chinese power. I was, again, struck by, you know, how much congruence there is between your approach to the Xinjiang issue, which is what you focus on, and my own thinking, my own priorities on this. Yours is a solution-focused approach. You write, while it's fine to condemn, what one actually does about a situation to positively change it is an entirely different matter. I mean, of course, it should be. It's incredibly frustrating to me when I was in a conversation with somebody who does a lot of work on Capitol Hill. And this person told me that in meetings with certain senators, their staff, congressmen and their staffs, they don't even make an effort. They say the quiet part out loud. They know that policy X is going to be actually harmful to the people who you're putatively trying to help, but they'd rather sort of wallow in indignation. They'd rather just sort of seethe in anger, and they get the sort of political capital of it. I'm not suggesting that that's what human rights groups do. In fact, many of them do wonderful, very, very important work. The people who have worked on this issue, you mentioned Darren Byler. We were fortunate enough to have him as a regular columnist at the China Project for a very long time. And his work is incredible, admirable. Jim Millward, for example, has been on the program many times. I've had, you know, Nuri Trakel on to talk the Xinjiang issue. But what do you think we can do? What does make a difference? What are some of the concrete steps that we should be taking?
It's a really tough one, and I've wrestled with it certainly when the camps appeared, the re-education camps, some called them concentration camps, appeared in 2017-18. It has been a tough thing. I mean, firstly, you can certainly morally condemn, as I say in the book. I mean, we can morally condemn, but I mean, morally condemn won't really get you very far with the Chinese government, who are the ones that are going to hopefully improve things, right? I mean, if you want to see improvement, you've got to think of arguments that will show this is a policy that won't work. I think actually, from what I've heard, it's definitely changed in the region, in Xinjiang. I mean, a lot of the education centers, the re-education centers, as they're called, they've been closed, right? So clearly this was not a policy that was sustainable.
But a lot of these people have been moved actually into the formal prison system, which is not a major improvement.
Yeah, I mean, it's an awful situation. And I suppose at the heart of it is the adamant belief of the Chinese government that this is a terrorist issue, right? I mean, I was at an event in Doha with some Chinese academics and people from the Middle Eastern region, and this issue came up. And, you know, every other part of this dialogue, you know, we were talking about the economy and about cooperation. Countries in the Middle East love China. You know, they love dealing with China. This issue came up. And, you know, the academic there who was dealing with China from China said something about, well, you know, this is a long-term problem. And I think she used some comment about, and this ethnic group have always been a problem for us.
Oh,
and,
gosh.
Of course, it went absolutely exploded. And then I kind of thought, it's likely that that kind of response from the Middle East is going to be more powerful than maybe the West talking about it. You know, the weird thing about this whole issue is that the dominant Muslim countries, Saudi Arabia and, you know, kind of others, they really haven't said anything.
No, in fact, they've taken Beijing's side off it.
Yeah, and that's been very conflicting. I mean, to me, that's certainly not sustainable, right? I mean, having, you know, your kind of believers in your faith having such a terrible time. I mean, there's some scholars that could do great work on this in the region. I mean, it must really, really great underneath. For others, I suppose the very, very, very broad point is, long term, it is clear we all need, Chinese and the outside world, a better security dialogue. I mean, at the moment, it's like we're talking Newtonian physics in a quantum physics world, right? I mean, we're using this old language. China is, the West is. You know, when the kind of the Munich conference, you know, I think Wang Yi, when he spoke, you know, it's sort of this very old-fashioned kind of view, and it's sort of everyone needs to talk in a different way, but we're not going to get there very easily because... when we come across issues like Xinjiang, I feel that clearly words like terrorism and this are thrown around, and China has these concepts that we clearly don't agree with. And we might be able to be more persuasive if we had just a better kind of discourse, right? But we don't have it now. We clearly don't have it now. And certainly when we kind of leap onto sort of calling it particular things like genocide, the Chinese government are definitely going to close down, right? I mean, they won't engage with that. Right. And I'm not getting into the legal arguments. I'm not a lawyer. I know that people have argued passionately that it is genocide. Okay. All I'm saying is the Beijing government that can have a big, big impact on the Xinjiang issue, probably the only ones that can, in changing their approach, will not engage with that language. That's just a political reality.
Right. You mentioned just now that we're, you know, still talking in a Newtonian language in a world of quantum, which reminds me, you bring up Stephen Kuhn and the idea of a paradigm shift. Look, we've seen China now sort of fly in the face of the kind of Whiggish teleology that assumed that everything would you know, move, converge on this, you know, what Fukuyama called like the end of history and the last man, right? I hope we're done with that. I hope we're all kind of past that. But I don't see a paradigm shift coming out of this. Instead, I see a lot of us sort of scrambling around to find reasons why China was that exception that sort of exonerate us. And you actually single out a couple of these. You know, can you unpack some of those and maybe add to that list? I think there were a couple more that you included. For how we're rationalizing what's actually happening historically.
Yeah, I mean, I think the sort of idea that this is a great Ponzi scheme, you know, that China, it's got to collapse at some point. I mean, a lot of people have engaged with that. Yes, indeed. And there's a wonderful book about the Russia-China border by Caroline Humphreys at Cambridge and a French scholar. And it has these sort of Russians interview basically saying, you know, there's a sort of town on the one side of the river, which is a Russian town. It's all very kind of quiet and, you know, old-fashioned. And then there's the Chinese town that's been built in about 15 years, which is just, you know, like kind of right. New York. And the Russians were saying, ah, it's all shoddy. It'll all fall down. You know, it's all a mirage, right? And I thought it was a great symbol of, you know, like this is what we look at Shanghai and these places, right? Yeah, you know, the high-speed train, and we say, all these things are going to fall apart soon, right? I mean, you know, and it's not sustainable. I mean, I think this is broadly a thing about narratives. I mean, that's, in a sense, what we'll, you know, we kind of have to talk about quite a lot these days. You know, our narrative about China is often just embraces like you know, kind of one punchline, right? You know, we're you know, one punchline. And it is clear that all that we've learned in the last 40 years is this is not a kind of soap opera where you're going to just have a nice, neat ending, right? It's going to have lots of different punchlines, and we just have to get used to lots of different narratives. It's not going to kind of, you know, disappear. It can't disappear. It's not going to collapse into nothing, because if it did, we all collapse with it. It's going to be more complicated. And that is not, you know, for China and for the outside world, that's the problem. There isn't a nice, neat, straightforward storyline that we can all kind of basically line up against. This is this massive historic shift. I mean, so maybe not a paradigm shift, but for the first time, as many years ago, an official, a British official said to me, what's difficult is this is the first time in modern history where a power has risen to such dominance and prominence with very different values. I mean, you know, if you think of Germany, Britain, and then, you know, America, there was sort of a lot of commonality, and that was difficult. This is, you know, the first time when something so different has happened, and therefore we have to think in a different way. We have to think in a different way.
That should start with trying to understand how China understands this process itself, right? And if you'll indulge me here, I have been translating a work by my grandfather, the last work that before he died. He was the historian Guo Tingyi, who was the founding director of the Academia Sinica's Modern History Bureau, and very, very well-known historian. And for some reason, nobody's translated his final work, which is actually a textbook used often in schools in Hong Kong and Taiwan, and now even in China. For a long time, his works were banned in both Taiwan and in China. He could be published in Hong Kong, but then he ended up, you know, spending most of his last three decades in the U.S. In any case, it's called Outline History of China, and reading it, it's not just, it doesn't read as just a dispassionate history of, you know, the last hundred and whatever years, but it's really the work of a modern, you know, Chinese intellectual who was part of this. You know, he was 15 when the May 4th movement happened, and he was really, you know, a high school student, but very caught up in it. You know, his contemporaries, he was, you know, friends with Luo Jialun and knew Hu Shi very well and all this. So, you know, he and then went on to write about this. And as I'm reading it, it strikes me just that it still fits that Joseph Levinson paradigm, which is something that I read in graduate school and I revisit from time to time, because that still really works for me in the way I understand modern Chinese history. But, you know, the Levinson question really was, you know, this idea that the great project for intellectuals for this whole century and a half that followed the Opium War was, you know, trying to create, to answer the question, you know, how do we create a China that is wealthy and powerful and somehow still consonant with we reconcile somehow with our heritage, with our traditional inheritance? This is the question that you've been talking about too. And you know, we're now seeing this play out. You know, we see this in the way, you know, Wang Huning and like Wang Hui talk about the, you know, Marxism with Chinese with Confucian characteristics, right? This sort of fusion of Marxism and Confucianism, which is a really interesting thing. So an idea that hit me a couple of years ago, and I've been sort of obsessed with, is that we're at a point now where it is wealthy and powerful, and where there is, it's still being sort of written down, but there is this sort of broad agreement that there has been this strange hodgepodge of an ideology with features of Marxism-Leninism, with features of Confucianism, with features of, you know, techno-authoritarianism, with features of whatever, you know. But it is somehow Chinese. It insists it is. And it seemed so far to have delivered the goods. Now, when I was thinking this idea, of course, this is before the current state of malaise, but still, I think the point holds. What is the new question? What is the new question that animates? I mean, once this is done, once they've put sort of, they've dotted the I's and crossed the T's on this final document, what is the new question?
For the Chinese.
For the Chinese. For Chinese elites, for Chinese intellectuals.
I mean, I think that they're going to increasingly have to answer how what they have done is important and not a threat for the outside world. I mean, I think
how to fit in with the outside, with the rest of the world.
Yeah, I mean, someone said at a thing I was attending this morning that, you know, the weird thing is that China is an amazing story and terrible PR, you know, what it's done in the last 40 years. I mean, it's sort of, messaging has been awful, and there must be deep reasons for that, because lots and lots of people in a long, long time have said, you know, like, just could you get your messaging right? It's not a terrible story you're telling, and it just hasn't happened. We've ended up with wolf warriors, and, you know, the issues are now. I think as China has become, I mean, it's a surprise for all of us, but I think for China, its prominence now is probably also a big, big shock, right? A big shock. It was never expected to happen so quickly. And I think it's This is a question which is sort of reversed. You know, usually you think about what do we as the outside world make of this? What does China make of it, where it is going to need to persuade and basically explain itself in ways which are in its self-interest and which are unpalatable to the outside world?
Right.
And it's increasingly important it does that. I mean, it's not that the world is forcing it to do anything. It's just that the China story, it's being told in the last 10 years under Xi Jinping, but the way in which this story is being sold and told has emotionally not really hit home with the outside world.
That's you know, empirically verifiable, right?
Empirically verifiable.
Yeah, I mean,
And I think there are lots of explanations for that, and there are all sorts of things that you could propose to kind of try and ameliorate that. But the point is that for most people, its difference is a problem for them, but it doesn't have to be. Westerners should, I mean, Enlightenment Westerners, we're into pluralism, right? We should be able to be okay with pluralism. We should really think of this story as an amazing thing where we're living in a world where a radically different country and set of values is finding its place. I mean, I'll give you an example. When I was an official, I remember, you know, we were kind of given a lot of stuff about how everyone's very negative. You know, Americans, Europeans, we're all very negative. We think the world is getting worse and worse. And then they basically put this very well-known data of actually numbers of Indians and Chinese alone whose wealth has increased means that the world is measurably better today than it was 30 years ago.
Right.
So, you know, this is kind of weird. There's actually this powerful story of phenomenal numbers of people living better lives, not just in China, in many places, but the West feels so awful.
Right.
So I suppose I'm sort of wondering why China, the way it tells that story for itself, it's kind of a very, very good story. And yet it's not really one that it manages to hit home with. It's emotionally kind of quite difficult for Westerners to hear this success, presumably because they think it's a success for the party state. But actually, that's not what it's success for. I mean, really, the party state in China just needs to get out of the PR. It can run the PR, but it needs to get out of it and let Chinese people individually speak more. I tell you, if you put Chinese people in a Western audience, as you well know, their stories are very powerful, mm-hmm, and actually, mm-hmm, extremely complex and extremely human. This is a very human story. At the moment, it is not being told well.
You have your own story about your bruising encounter with the state of discourse in China right now. Tell us a little bit about what it is that seemed to pique the ire of so many people in our community and your reaction to that.
There are many, many things. The pandemic was a moment, I think, when all sorts of people became interested in China. You remember this goes in phases. Do you remember in 2008 and the Olympics?
Sure.
And suddenly people who had never shown the slightest interest in China came very, very interested in it, and then they disappeared happily. But now, you know, obviously China has kind of come much more topical. To me, what was frustrating, and I think many people have found this frustrating, is, well, this is a complicated story. No one is saying that there aren't many challenges about China and what it's doing on many, many different levels, because that's the way it is. But it's certain that if you just come along with a good, bad kind of, you know, rubric, we're not going to be able to deal with it. It's
right.
Just not fit for purpose. And that's all I felt I was saying. And I do remember, you know, in kind of saying that, this was immediately kind of labeled as, you know, kind of
apology,
you know, and apologetics. And by people, I think it's most difficult by people who you kind of really didn't expect it from. One thing I think is disappointing, and I know it will probably be irritating to some of your viewers, but your listeners, is I think the academic community in America and Britain has been part of the problem. You know, in some ways part of the problem. I think they have been very politicized. There's been people who have been strongly critical of China, and I mean, they're very sincere, I get that. And there's also people that have probably been strongly supportive, they're sincere, I get that. But I don't think there's been much of how do we kind of just try and be neutral on this? the issues of, you know, kind of talking about China with colleagues sometimes can be, why aren't you condemning this? Why aren't you doing this about Xinjiang or things like this? And on the other hand, people who are saying, you know, that you're over-politicized. And actually, I feel as a kind of community that has a got, you know, the China expert community is not huge, and it's got a big, big function now. And I really ask this question, I'm sure I will be slated like hell, but did we do a good job in the last 4 years? Did we really do a good job? Hmm. Did we step up when a lot of very, very ignorant people were banging on about China, the people that knew the least were speaking the most? Did we insert ourselves in that and say, it's more complicated? That's all we had to do, was say, it's more complicated. Okay? Did we do that? I think either people didn't take part in that, because if they did, I know I did and I got slated for it, or they probably kind of inserted themselves and actually really, really kind of gave people firepower to say China was doing a terrible job. I think not many, to be honest, really kind of, I don't know, really kind of tried to wrestle with this complexity. And
the ones that did all came on Seneca, so I'm pretty happy about that.
I mean, I think what you've done is given a platform to people to explore that complexity, and that's fantastic.
Yeah, that's the whole idea here.
Yeah, no, that's really, really fantastic. But I mean, I think that kind of community sort of, you could call it navel gazing or self-reflection, is important. I don't know. Did we do a good job? I mean, you're in a better position to turn, you know, tell them. I can push this question back at you.
Some of us did, some of us did. But no, on balance, no. I think it was yeah, largely a failure. And I think a lot of us were just simply overwhelmed. I mean, it became just so tiring. Yeah, I think I saw a lot of people who see themselves sort of, you know, as I do, as somebody who's trying to be dispassionate while being passionate at the same time, and you know that is possible, but it's exhausting.
Yeah,
when you're constantly being attacked from both sides.
Absolutely.
Toward the top of our conversation, you were talking about how, you know, startling the intensity of the China threat discourse has gotten, and how for so many people China isn't just a problem, but it's, you know, the problem. You put it that way, I believe, in the book. It's all out of proportion to what China's actually done in terms of you know, actions on the ground. It's really about the potential to do, you know, what it could do, right? And of course, as we know, acting on the assumption that China will turn that kind of potential power into kinetic power actually has the terrible effect of bringing that on. You know, it's self-fulfilling prophecy, right? Well, I feel like we're almost too late to do anything about that. I mean, we seem like that's baked into to the at least in the Beltway. That's what it feels like to me. And at this point, is the best we can do just mitigation?
Well, I think, yeah. I mean, you were talking about paradigms earlier. I mean, I suppose another word for that would be frameworks. And I think if you look at geopolitics as a sort of, you know, kind of issue of regions and countries, then sure, China is the big issue, the big security issue. There's a book, I think it's by Toby Ord, called The Precipice, about existential issues facing humanity. And China occurs in the index for that, I think, about 3 or 4 times, just as a side thing. It talks about artificial intelligence, environment, global warming, the nuclear proliferation, and, you know, meteor and stuff. And I mean, what's striking is if you kind of put the geopolitics in those sort of 4 silos, basically, then China isn't the sort of same thing. I mean, global warming, China, for whatever issues it's having at the moment, has got to be a partner, right? And at least they're environmentalists. You know, they might not be doing what people want them to, but they're environmentalists. For self-interest, but they're environmentalists. Artificial intelligence, you know well. I mean, we are getting close to creating some scary, scary things, you know? China took part in a seminar in Britain on, you know, artificial intelligence. It's going to have a big problem. It's way ahead in some of that technology, and it's going to create things that it's going to be a problem for us, right? I mean, the extraordinary and unthinkable kind of, you know, possibility of us creating entities that are more intelligent than us. I mean, mind you, some days you don't think that would be that difficult, but, you know, I mean, kind of really, that's, in fact, in Toby Ord's book, that's the big one. He said, that's the big one. I mean, that's going to really be the big one. And it's getting scarily close. China is definitely with us on that, right? Nuclear proliferation and meteor, you know, these are other issues. China is more an ally than a kind of foe. I mean, nuclear proliferation, you could argue, that's more complicated. But on those big issues, when we see the world that way, when we take off our geopolitical kind of, you know, geopolitics as countries kind of thing, spectacles, and then we put on the generic issues, it's a different world. And in that world, actually, already, you know, America and others have dialogues with China, which are empirical, practical, pragmatic. It can be done. So I'm optimistic about that. If these problems get more intense, and they will, global warming and artificial intelligence, and, you know, those two are going to basically get more intense, our way of thinking will probably change. Hegel said, understanding starts on the ledge, peering into the abyss. And that's probably going to be the moment when suddenly we have extreme weather everywhere, which is happening. Suddenly we're having, you know, kind of worrying things about, you know, sort of new systems, new AI systems. Then I think things change. And then a lot of these issues which seem so intractable today might be very, very different. It's about the framework.
We're here on the peering down into the abyss, certainly with the global warming problem, and yet our politicians are still pushing to ban Chinese, you know, renewable energy, solar panels and wind turbines, to ban electric vehicles, even electric vehicle batteries. I just, you know, if that's a national security issue and global warming isn't, then we've got our priorities completely wrong. Anyway, what a pleasure it's been to talk to you. Let's move on now to the recommendations section, where I ask you to give me a book that you've read recently, or you know, a television show or a movie or some piece of music you've enjoyed, maybe something related to Salzburg here where we are.
Right. Well, oh God, there's been a lot. But I mean, I actually weirdly started to read Ferdinand Braudel's Long Histories of Capitalism and Western history, and I was really amazed. I mean, these are from the 70s, and you know, I was aware of them for a long time, but it made very clear that Europe's prosperity for the last 400 years was because of its trade links and its sea links to Asia. I mean, really, really, and it kind of made me realize that globalization is an old story, and that Europe has been actually a winner in that story for much of the last 400 years. So I really enjoyed reading these books because they're kind of full of little vignettes and kind of little kind of things about, you know, what happened in day-to-day life in the past. Just about this book, one thing, it sort of made a really powerful point about daily life. If you were interviewing Voltaire, it's likely that, you know, his ideas and stuff, there wouldn't be a problem, right? You know, it would all be very comprehensible. When you start talking about your daily life, and you said to Voltaire, you got on a plane from America to come here, you know, we're using this technology, where suddenly everything would fall apart. And it would be, our daily lives have many things that have changed, even though our ideas probably have stayed quite similar.
Sure.
And I thought this was really kind of a powerful thing, that the changes in daily lives is where things really are real. And if you think in China, you know, in the last 50 years, how profound.
Yeah.
That you go from a society within living memory where people didn't have TVs, didn't have radio, you know, didn't have phones, to a society now where you can get a high-speed train from Shanghai to Beijing in 4 hours.
Yeah.
This is, I think, what we should look at more. It's just these very simple things, very profound. So this book was very helpful to sort of
remember
bring that
when
back
I
to
asked
mind.
You at the beginning of our conversation what you know that feature of the kind of Chinese worldview that you should try to imbue in other people. That's the one I always go to. It's just like the compressed, incredible nature of modernization, of changes in daily life. That's what I always try to impress upon people. You need to keep that in mind, that that's going to affect the way they see the world. Fantastic. I have by the way, you know, you were talking about reading Braudel and his history. I've been fascinated by the silver exchange after, you know, the Potosi mine and after, you know, the mines in Mexico and Peru, and how that affected Spain especially and really the world, about, you know, the Manila galleons and everything, but and especially how it affected China. There's a book that I just started. It's really interesting. It's by a woman named Xu Jin, I think, or Jin Xu. I don't know. I don't know her. She seems to be a very young economist, a little on the neoliberal spectrum for me. I can sort of see a lot of quotes from, you know, the Milton Friedman and Hayek. But it's good. It's called Empire of Silver.
It's really interesting.
I mean, historically, it's really
which China never had. I mean, Jessica Rawson, the great historian at Oxford, gave a talk recently I went to, and she made this very obvious point I'd never thought about. China doesn't have gold and silver of its own. You know, right. It doesn't have deposits.
Silver came from Japan. I mean,
And Mexico. And places, and so
Mexico.
Just, so this seems very, very obvious why this country likes accruing gold and silver.
But also, you know, why they would move to a single whip taxation system in the Ming that was entirely paid in silver, something that China didn't natively have. Right. So yeah, the whole global trading system of the early modern period is a kind of new subject of fascination for me. But for my recommendation, though, I want to say that, you know, during this kind of hiatus after the demise of the China Project, it's 3 months, I had a lot of time to read. And one thing that I did is I reread Hilary Mantel's wonderful trilogy on Cromwell, set in the court of Henry VIII. And wow, they're just such amazing books. It's such a tragedy that she's no longer with us. But Wolf Hall, Bring Up the Bodies, and The Mirror and the Light. I cannot think of any works of historical fiction that are just more fully realized and just work as literature as well as these.
Yeah.
It's just, they're so marvelous. So that's my recommendation. If you have already read them, do it again. They're just, they hold up so well. You'll read so much more into it. More familiarity with the characters and everything. So, Carrie Brown, thank you so much for coming on.
Great honor to finally meet you, Kaiser, and you're doing a great job. So I'm really glad that you're starting this again. And I think your platform is really important now more than ever. I hope it's a big, big success.
Thanks. Thanks so much. You've been listening to the Seneca Podcast. The show is produced, recorded, engineered, edited, and mastered by me, Kaiser Guo. Support the show through Substack at seneca.substack.com, where there's a growing offering of terrific original China-related writing and audio. Or email me at senecapod@gmail.com if you have ideas on how you can help out. And don't forget to leave a review on Apple Podcasts. Enormous gratitude to the University of Wisconsin-Madison's Center for East Asian Studies for supporting the show this year. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week. Take care.